morning and happy Monday. My name is Melissa Carter. I'm your host of She Persisted. Thank you for being here. Hope you had a great weekend. I had a really cool experience that I've never had before. Indulge me as a new mom, but I went to my son's school for the first time and had lunch with him. So Friday after the show, my son's daycare had a Thanksgiving luncheon, and Mama Melissa went and sat with my son and had Thanksgiving lunch with him, had Thanksgiving meal with him. It's neat because it's the little things for me. I'm the person that I'm so nostalgic about little things and little moments, and that's one of them. Because to be in a position where I could actually go to my, you know, son's school and be the big parent and be there and see him be excited to see me and excited to be with me is just, it was neat. And so, yeah, I've already had Thanksgiving dinner, by the way. But it was, I mean, in Atlanta, let me just tell you, it's been cooler lately. But for the most part, it's been shorts weather still. Now, I live in the South. I live in the deep South. And yes, we're used to having warmer weather all the time, but we're not Florida. Like, if you're not familiar with this area, Florida, right there on the coast, I get where they're in shorts all year long. But in Georgia, I mean, at one point, and I grew up in Tennessee, at one point we did have seasons. And we did have fall and then winter. We had temperatures cool down by Halloween and be a little more light jacket weather, but certainly not shorts and t-shirts. So to have a Thanksgiving meal, I'm adjusting to the fact that I'm eating the turkey and the dressing while I'm still not in a heavy coat. But it was a great experience. So that was really cool. Thank you for indulging me. But I was very proud of my boy. Very proud to be his mom. Love that little man. Some other stories from over the weekend I wanted to share with you. One student at the University of Kentucky. Now, she was parked legally in a handicapped parking spot. She had a placard showing, and then someone stuck nasty messages all over her car because they saw her walk away and decided that she wasn't handicapped. So I guess we have this idea that you need the space because you physically, like your legs may not work well, but actually she was doing radiation treatments for a brain tumor. So she did need to have the handicapped parking spot. And obviously, if she got the placard, those handicapped placards are given by doctors and they're given on a temporary basis. So it's not like you can buy one of those and just steal a handicapped parking space. So the student's name is Lexi Baskin. And here are her words.
So I went into the school for about an hour and a half to meet with a professor about an exam. And I came back out to my car covered in bright signs and with stuff on them. There was a letter, obviously, and it said basically like that I was like a horrible person for taking someone's parking spot, even though I look fine. It kind of breaks my heart because of the fact that there are so many people that are being like, oh my gosh, I went through the same thing, or like have messaged me on Facebook and said like, I went through this, and they share their story with me. And like, that's why I want to get out there and make people aware that just because you can't see something, like, doesn't mean that people aren't going through it.
It just goes back to the same message we have said on the show before about kind of slow your roll, analyze the situation. People's intention was correct in defending a handicapped parking space, but I think you have to redefine handicapped so that you don't mistakenly stress out somebody who is already going through something very stressful. So I'm sorry that she had to go through that. It wasn't a handicapped placard that I had a similar experience with, but it was a note on my car at a very inopportune time. So I lived in an apartment complex. This was when I was in my early 30s. And one of the worst things you can hear is somebody yell fire. I was home on a Friday night watching television and somebody screamed fire. And I looked out my window and the apartment complex was shaped like a horseshoe. So I was in a long building. There was a long building in the back and then another building. So it's like a U shaped. And when I looked out my window toward across the courtyard to the other building, sure enough, there was fire. There were flames that were starting to, you know, kind of pulsate in windows across the courtyard. I couldn't believe it. And so I, at the time, had a dog and two cats. The first thought I had was them. Well, I think the first thought I had was put a bra on. And the second thought is I had them. And one of the cats scurried and was not willing to let me catch him or her. I can't remember which cat it was, but I had a golden retriever and two Siamese, and one of the Siamese scurried off, and I opened the back door. So the back door of my apartment at this complex actually went into a basement that went into the outside. So I opened the back door hoping that that cat, in the worst case scenario, would find its way out away from the smoke and the fire. And I grabbed the other cat and my dog and ran outside and put him in the car. And then I ran out into the courtyard where the other neighbors were gathering. And then one of the guys said, hey, let's move our cars in case this gets bad, because all of our parking spaces jutted up right to the building. I agreed. So I got in the car and parked it on the street. Now, the street where the apartment complex was not a highway. It was a side street. So it was like a neighborhood. And so we all parked our cars along the way. It didn't take firefighters long to get there. And they instructed us that we needed to sit across the street, not in the courtyard of the building, obviously, but across the street where there was a grassy patch. And they instructed us all to sit there, and we would not be allowed back into our apartments until everything was clear. So it was about 9 o'clock when we noticed the fire, and it was about 2 a.m. when I was allowed back into my apartment. Fortunately, there was a firewall right smack in the middle of the U. So my apartment was on the other side of the firewall. So all the apartments to one side of that firewall where the fire was were all destroyed or smoke damaged, and then the rest of us had no damage at all. So I was that was an education into firewalls. So since I had an apartment that I was able to go back into, first thing to do is to go get the animals and let them back into the building. When I got to my car, I realized there was a note on the windshield, and the note said asshole. And now, mind you, my car was parked behind the fire truck. There were several fire trucks that showed up, and they parked along this neighborhood street, of course, in front of the apartment complex. And my car literally was parked behind one of the fire trucks with its lights flashing. And those fire trucks arrived shortly after we evacuated the building. So there was not a space of time where my car was sitting on the street with my animals in it without that fire truck being there. The letter, I mean, the person, it was like a notebook paper and pen, and this person spent, I believe, a page or two telling me what a piece of shit I was for allowing my animals to be in the car unattended. Now, I don't know when this person got a chance to do that, because I was not that far away from my car in this grassy knoll, but obviously my attention was directed toward the building and not toward my car. I mean, I went to check on the animals every now and again, but when I checked on the animals, the note wasn't there. It was only there toward the end. And again, that just reiterates the fact that the fire truck was blatantly in front of the person who left the note on my car. I was fascinated that this person had no concept of the fact that that car and those animals might be there because of the fire that was happening just feet away from them. But I kept that note for a long time because I thought it was hilarious. So again, in your stress, maybe check your surroundings first before you leave a note on somebody's handicapped car or somebody's car in front of a fire. Just your public service message for the moment. Okay, another story, though, that's much more of a feel-good story, and one that I love, obviously, because last week you heard about my kidney transplant anniversary, and stories like this are near and dear to my heart. There's a 74-year-old man in Utah. His name is Wayne Winters. And he has been walking up and down the roads near his house, holding signs to find a kidney donor for his wife. If you have seen this story, it is so charming because this man loves his wife and he will go to any extreme. It just brings tears to my eyes to make sure that he saves her life. Well, she did get a kidney. She just had a transplant, so his efforts have gone rewarded, and now he's planning to keep walking to find donors for other people. I'm telling you, it chokes me up. So here is Wayne talking about his experience.
I was just overwhelmed. I didn't know what to think. They said, I saw you on TV, and I like the story. I want to help your wife. Between 700 and 800. Filled my phone up. I'm sitting here with this full phone. We have a kidney for you. Get down here. Just to watch somebody hooked up to dialysis is a traumatic experience. So I held my wife's hand. If she can have a good 5 years, that would be awesome. You know, I have my wife back. I would spend part of my days walking with my sign to see how many I can get. A lot of young girls, young women, fell in love with what they saw. Not me. but the idea of helping somebody with a kidney. Think about it. We could start a kidney revolution, and that would be so great.
I mean, seriously, I'm just welling up again. And 5 years, I mean, keep it in perspective, too, that he is thrilled to have his wife just for 5 years. And how, you know, we think 5 years is, you know, nothing. I mean, even in job interviews, they ask the question, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And for many people, it's not to be alive. So I just, everything about that story is just romantic and charming and wonderful. And the fact that he wants to continue the effort to save other people. So what do I always say? Be an organ donor. Whew. DonateLifeFloat.org. DonateLifeFloat.org. That is the website where Donate Life is a group that has a float in the Rose Bowl parade that I have the honor of riding in on New Year's Day coming up. And they have a place there where you can sign up to be an organ donor. So whether it's a kidney or a lung or a liver or a heart, whatever it is you want to give, you can definitely save a life. And isn't that what a hero is being all about? So, Wayne is so fantastic. All right. So coming up, somebody else, another man that is doing great things and has a charming story. And his name is David Newman. Now, he is the CEO of Operation Lunchbox, which is an organization that helps feed children who don't have food when they leave school. And the fact that he is where he is because of his mama. And I will introduce you to him coming up on She Persisted here on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Melissa Carter.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1995. That was the day that healthcare workers in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, walked off the job in a wildcat strike. Budget cuts in Alberta, under the leadership of Premier Ralph Klein, had hit healthcare particularly hard. A massive restructuring plan called for deep cuts, privatization, and reducing services. As part of this trend, the Calgary Regional Health Authority had decided to contract out the work of 120 laundry personnel. The workers were members of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, Local 8. The laundry workers walked off the job in protest. Soon, they were joined in solidarity on the picket line by housekeepers, orderlies, nurses, and other hospital workers. 8 hospitals across the city were impacted by the walkout. Community members joined in and marched on the picket lines, frustrated by the government cuts. Twice, the Labor Relations Board ordered the workers to go back to their jobs. Twice, the workers refused. The strike spread to Calgary, where more than 2,500 healthcare workers walked off the job. In Edmonton, workers stood ready to strike. Talk of a general strike began to circulate. In Calgary, the union met with management for a 19-hour marathon bargaining session, and the 10-day strike ended. The health authority agreed to wait 8 months before contracting out any labor. Workers were given severance packages, and the government stopped any further cuts to the industry. But the settlement did little to appease the dissatisfaction of the healthcare workers. The strike had also shown the potential connections between workers' issues on the job and the concerns of community members. The cutbacks hurt both labor and the general public, and brought them together to stand in solidarity. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. Check out this clip from my show.
We previously talked about diplomats coming to Washington, D.C. and staying at Donald Trump's relatively new Washington, D.C. hotel. We've known that for months. Last week, we heard and learned that the State Department was recommending, you could call it suggesting, you could call it encouraging foreign dignitaries on official visits to Washington, D.C. to stay at Donald Trump's Washington, D.C. hotel. And now Donald Trump's endlessly articulate and graceful press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, promoted Donald Trump's Hawaii hotel during a conversation with the press. Trump has been, or was at the time, en route to Asia. And en route to Asia, he stopped in Hawaii. And during the stop in Hawaii, Donald Trump went to the Trump Hotel in Waikiki. He supposedly had separated from his businesses. This was an official trip. So Sarah Huckabee Sanders was correctly asked, Trump supposedly wasn't involved with his businesses anymore or with his former employees, whatever, with the entire thing. And this was an official trip. Why did Donald Trump go to his hotel in Waikiki, Hawaii? And Sarah Huckabee Sanders said, well, it has been a tremendously successful project. And he wanted to say hello and thank you to the employees for all their hard work. This is sort of like a product placement, right? She's editorializing that it has been tremendously successful. I would actually like on Sarah Huckabee Sanders's podium a light that turns on that says sponsored by or product placement whenever one of the Trump cash generating ventures is mentioned. Why is Trump meeting with employees that he isn't even supposed to be involved with as president of the United States? And the idea that it's just a visit, that it has no effect, is silly, right? Trump shows up, the hotels and properties end up in the news, pictures are taken. This has a direct impact on business at every single one of these locations. And in the end, Trump knows that he owns them, or in some cases, he's just licensing his name to them. But either way, Trump knows that Trump hotels exist and that they are his or ways that his family makes money. Former White House ethics chief Norm Eisen says pretty simply, this is an ethics violation, tweeting, ethics violation by the press secretary under 5 CFR 2635.702, can't promote Trump's businesses, same violation as Kellyanne Conway committed. And that's a reference to, we covered this months ago, when Kellyanne Conway promoted Trump's daughter Ivanka Trump's fashion line on Fox News from inside the White House press briefing room. Remember when President Jimmy Carter had to put his peanut farm in Georgia in a blind trust to avoid a possible appearance of a conflict of interest? That was nothing compared to this. And the truth is that mere possible constitutional violations of the Emoluments Clause, they're barely going to register when it is scandal after scandal, when it is indictments at the highest levels of Trump's own administration and campaign staffers. And in the end, we go back to the question we always have with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, which is she even telling the truth, right? This was sort of lost in the shuffle until I just thought about it. Is this a tremendously successful hotel? Sarah Huckabee Sanders lies so much that even referring to this as a successful hotel might be part of the lie. I don't know. I quite frankly don't care. But yet more ethics concerns coming from Trump staffers and Trump funneling cash into his businesses that, of course, he knows he still owns or is connected to.
You've been listening to part of the David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and more, go to davidpakman.com and check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedavidpakmanshow.
Did you know that the number one fear of Americans is public speaking? And you may share in that fear. And you may have done the research to see programs that are supposed to help you out, but they require you to go an entire weekend with a bunch of people that you're intimidated to get in front of and spend a lot of money. Well, guess what? You can do my online course called Speak Your Spirit. I designed it especially for shy people, and it only costs you $50. That's it. SpeakYourSpirit.com. Start sharing what you want to say. SpeakYourSpirit.com. Back to She Persisted. I'm your host, Melissa Carter. Earlier, I talked about how I went to my son's Thanksgiving luncheon at his preschool. And here we were, children from, you know, infancy all the way up to being prepared to go to kindergarten and their parents or caregivers eating a Thanksgiving meal. I mean, turkey and dressing and sides. And the meals were provided mainly by the school and parents. So parents brought a covered dish. You know, it's very potluck. Katie wasn't able to be there because of her work, so she provided the food, again, which is smart because she's the better cook of the two. And I went and physically was there with Mr. Carter during the luncheon. And we enjoyed turkey and dressing and delicious sides and didn't think twice about it. We were just celebrating Thanksgiving. But a lot of kids, and maybe even some of the kids in that building, when they left that facility, had no idea where their next meal was coming from. And that's a problem that David Newman knows very well. He is the CEO of Operation Lunchbox, which is an organization here in Georgia that provides groceries on a weekly basis to homeless and underprivileged children. And I wanted you to be aware of David and his program. Go ahead and explain to us what Operation Lunchbox is.
Okay, what we are, we're a public school food relief program organization. What we do, we provide groceries on a weekly basis to students that are in need. Either they're homeless or considered homeless by poverty standards.
And explain to people what that poverty level is, because it's pretty, I mean, it's pretty low.
If a kid receives free or reduced lunch, they're basically considered to be under the poverty level, considering how the counties base their statistics. I don't really know how they get the statistics per se, but if they're on free or reduced lunch, they qualify from government standpoints to be under the poverty line.
Now, David, explain to me, like, of course, my first reaction is how in the world is a child in this situation? And number two, how in the world is the school not helping them? So explain to me the politics involved in the schools supplying the children with their food.
What the schools do is they do provide some schools provide breakfast and every school provides lunch. But when they leave school, it's the parents or the person that's raising the kid or whatever's responsibility to feed them outside the school.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is we take care of the outside of the school. We provide, like, say for instance, a grandparent that's raising their grandkid can't get government assistance because they don't actually have full custody.
Mm-hmm.
So we're helping that gap until that parent can come back and get their kid or whatever the situation may be.
So, David, explain to me how Operation Lunchbox came about and how you got involved. Was there a certain incident that took place? How did you hear about this and this problem?
What honestly happened was, well, I actually grew up in poverty and it was all around me. And my family, my mom was the one that cooked for the whole neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we barely had enough, we had everybody at our house eating. So we always had a heart for everybody that was hungry.
Mm-hmm.
But the way Operation Lunchbox came about, I was sitting at a school one day, and I actually started Operation Lunchbox as a devastation relief. And what we were going to do was do tornadoes, hurricanes, and take care of stuff like that, because we had a friend that died in Atlanta, and actually Barnesville, through the tornado that hit here a few years back.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So we were going to provide assistance in that while sitting there at school, and out of the blue, this little girl's like, I was talking about what I was doing with some of the principals, and she's like, "Mister, kids is on the devastation too."
Mm-hmm.
It kind of took me back to when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I've already seen the poverty. I lived in poverty. I looked at the principal. I said, "Do y'all have any students that need fed?" She said, "Yes, we do." And handed me a list, a number. And that next day, we brought groceries back and started back in January 2015 feeding the students.
How was it beginning this program? Because, you know, if somebody's inspired by you, because this show is nationwide. So let's say somebody's inspired by what you're doing in Georgia and wants to do the same thing for their communities. What is the process to get that started? Because I personally have no idea how I would start something like this and be able to provide the food and organize that effort.
Everything's happened by word of mouth for us. We started with three schools that first week, and we grew from 63 kids now to 1,800 students.
Mm.
So we actually feed 1,800 kids every week, and we're about to add a potential 2,500 more kids.
Wow. It's great that you're able to service them, but it's a shame that many children are in need of food outside of the school.
Yes, ma'am. The numbers are really a lot higher than what I expected. When I first went in, I was thinking maybe about 2-3% of the school would need something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But the need is a lot bigger than even I expect.
So where do you get the food? Like, how do you organize? Like, who provides the food for these students?
We have a few regular donors that donate on a weekly basis. We have a few partners, a couple of corporate partners that sponsor and give money periodically. We get grants from companies that do grants because we're not a 501c3 nonprofit. So the money comes from all them. And we also partner with a grocery store, Food Depot, and they give us our groceries at cost.
Mm-hmm. And I guess when, like you said, word of mouth, not only from the schools, but I'm sure as these corporate partners and these private donors and this grocery store company, once they heard about it, I'm sure they didn't hesitate to chip in.
Most people, once they heard, they're like, "How can we help?"
Mm-hmm.
We want to do what we can to help, because we didn't realize the need was as bad also.
Right.
And when I tell them, when we talk about the areas that were are bad, they're shocked because in our county that we're the couple of counties we deal in, the county, the one you think would be the worst is actually better off than the one you would think wouldn't be.
Right. So, well, and is it that you think because so much attention is drawn to the counties that you think are in need, and so there's a spotlight there, but people ignore more rural areas that they may not realize are in trouble?
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Most people look at, as a whole, that this place looks like it's okay, whatever, but on the inside, it's not okay.
Right.
I think that's the issue.
Let me ask, and forgive my ignorance, because I just learned about Operation Lunchbox, last week? So I'm excited about this. When the kid goes out of school, how were they given the food? Like, how were these children provided the food? And do they take them home, or is there a specific place that they eat their meal?
They actually take them home. We actually provide groceries that they can fix meals when they get home.
Okay.
So what we do is, We get certain items that are easily fixed because of some of these kids are actually cooking the meals themselves, even at 7 years old.
Right.
So we give them anything that's non-perishable and easy to make. So what we do is we put them in black bags so that when the counselors give it to them, another student won't be able to pick on them because they don't know what's in the bag.
Right.
So we discreetly give them bags. And they take them home and prepare the food at their wherever they're staying.
Wow. If you don't mind, I'm fascinated by your history, with respect. I don't mean fascinated in a negative way. And But since this show is mainly geared toward women, I'm curious and I want to learn more about the influence that your mother had. If you don't mind kind of going further into detail about how your home became that house in the neighborhood.
Honestly, looking back, I really... My mom started out just because she didn't want us to be out getting in trouble, doing whatever. She invited everybody to our house. So she can keep an eye on us. And so we were the hangout house.
Right.
But at the same time, she started realizing that these neighbors were coming here because they were hungry too. Because they would go through our cabinets or whatever. My mom was one of them parents that said, "This is your house too, so make yourself at home. Anything in there you could have."
Mm-hmm.
And some of these people would come in and just eat like they've never ate.
Right.
Some of our friends. So my mom, and she's always had that heart, so she's like, every time she would cook, she would call the neighborhood up, like, "Y'all come on, dinner time."
Mm-hmm.
So she's always just had that heart. And back when I was younger, I mean, I used to kind of get angry. I'm like, "Why are you giving my food away?"
Right.
Like, I'm eating less because you're giving all my food away. But as I got older, I realized what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what we kind of pride ourselves in. We can't give these kids the best meals, but we can give them something.
And
that's kind of how my mom looked at it.
Right. And obviously, what she did influenced you and what you do for a living now. Do you think your life would have been different had she not been that way with as the house in the neighborhood?
Most likely, probably, because I grew up, I used to be kind of selfish. So had I not really sat back and watched what she did, I may have still been selfish and not wanted to give back. But because my mom had that heart, as I got older, it touched my heart and I wanted to do the same thing.
Yeah. Is there any advice you would give to mothers out there, whether they're in poverty or not? I mean, as a grown man who obviously was influenced by how you grew up, despite the fact that you, if people looked on paper and saw where you came from, obviously there's some people out there that feel that you are where you come from and would have written you off. But, I mean, obviously it doesn't matter your economic status if you have a great influence in your life. So is there any advice you would give to women on how to be the best mom they can be to their child?
The only advice and what I took from when I was growing up is love your kids and be, no matter your circumstance, do something positive and show them a positive influence so that later in life, if they become well off or just comfortable, that they can give back.
Right. I love it, David. Now, if we have listeners who obviously are in the state of Georgia, and then for those who are not in the state of Georgia that are inspired and want to learn more about you, where's the best place that they can find out all about Operation Lunchbox?
We have an app in your app store, Operation Lunchbox, and it's a free app. It talks about what we do, keeps you updated with events, all this and that.
Download
and we also
right
have our web.
Downloading it right now, David. Go ahead.
And we also have our website, OperationLunchbox.org.
Okay, great.
Both of the app and our website are being updated, but they're up and running right now.
All right. As you grow, I mean, obviously you have more to provide, so I understand why you have to probably keep those updated. David, thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for what you do. And I appreciate you taking the time to explain it to us and let us know about a problem that I guarantee most people who just heard that had no idea how many children are hungry.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right, David. Have a great day.
You too.
Isn't he great? And isn't that idea great? I had no idea how many kids were affected. And I love a good old-fashioned Southern, yes, ma'am, a time or two, too. We'll have a link to Operation Lunchbox on our website, shepersistedshow.com. And like I said, if you're not in the Georgia area, you can still take a look at it and see how you may start a similar program in your area. Now, going from kids who don't have enough to people who have way too much, coming up next is my can of crazy. And there is something that is available this holiday season. If you were tempted by this, guess where you're going? In my can. Next on She Persisted, here on the Progressive Voices Network, I'm Melissa Carter.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The New Jersey AFL-CIO says the election of Phil Murphy as governor and Sheila Oliver as lieutenant governor speaks to the unmatched mobilization efforts of organized labor and the New Jersey AFL-CIO's political program that is unparalleled by any other in our state or nation. AFL-CIO in New Jersey says that effort included thousands of union volunteers, national, state, and local affiliates, central labor councils, and building trades councils. Phone banks were activated and thousands of mail pieces delivered statewide. In addition to the governor and lieutenant governor, labor in New Jersey also expanded pro-labor majorities in the state legislature. 43 rank-and-file union members running for public office won their elections. New Jersey's AFL-CIO says working people needed a victory and organized labor delivered. Republicans in the Wisconsin State Senate have made it the 28th state to call for a new U.S. constitutional convention. It takes 34 states to actually call a convention to rewrite America's Constitution. The resolution 28 states have now passed says that the purpose of the constitutional convention shall be, quote, for the limited purpose of requiring the federal government to operate under a balanced budget. But once the Constitutional Convention Pandora's box is open, it could well turn into a runaway convention where other constitutional rewrites could happen. And since it's driven by state legislatures controlled by Republicans, America could wake up one day to a new U.S. Constitution written essentially by Republicans. Just 14 states had legislatures totally controlled by Republicans in 2009. In 2017, there are 33 such states. In 2010, the GOP was able to gerrymander congressional districts, cementing the Republican state-level political power and protecting its congressional seats. The constitutionality of that gerrymandering is being decided in a case from Wisconsin currently before the U.S. Supreme Court. The Pension Benefits Guaranty Corporation, PBGC, has reached a new agreement with Sears that will put $500 million into two Sears pension plans that have approximately 100,000 people in them. The deal frees the struggling Sears from having to protect subsidiaries holding real estate and intellectual property for the benefit of those pension plans. The deal is expected to take a few months to close, and when it does, Sears will be free to sell off more of its assets. Sears has been losing billions of dollars in recent years. WIN is America's multimedia news voice for workers.
We need to make more money. You know, what they're paying us, the greedy corporations, they just want to pay us what they want to pay us. And it's not right.
We are sick of an economy and a democracy that are rigged against us.
Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
Ever really think about what ideas can do? Well, then you realize the size of the thinker does not determine or even limit the size of the idea. Well, that's what my children's book is all about. It's called Whale of an Idea. And if you need a gift for a baby shower or a birthday, I would love for you to consider it. Whale of an Idea, available now online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
One, two, three, four.
Normal people, stupid things. Today's entry comes from the little blue box. Actually, the box is probably a little bigger, but you know, when you get a blue box of jewelry, it comes from Tiffany & Company. This is not jewelry, but they do have a new item on their website. And let me give you the description. Tin can. That's right. And in their descriptions, they talk about their everyday objects. That's where this tin can is listed under. And they say they transform items into handcrafted works of art, like utility items. And a classic tin can, I'm not kidding, is upgraded in sterling silver and shining vermeil. And it's about 4.5 inches high. It has the instantly recognizable signature Tiffany blue hue in the design's enamel. Yes, it is a tin can from Tiffany & Company, and the going price, $1,000. Let me repeat, $1,000. Now, Tiffany has every right, of course, to put this on their website, but the person or people who pay $1,000 for a tin can from Tiffany, congratulations, you are an idiot, and you made it into my can of crazy. Now, idiot was kind of strong, wasn't it? Did I go too far? I mean, can of crazy is enough. And ironically, I didn't even catch that can of crazy. My can of crazy is not as expensive as a $1,000 can from Tiffany. But anyway, we'll have more She Persisted coming up on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Melissa Carter.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about the Great Chicago Fire of 1871 and the lessons learned from it that changed our cities. The most thorough analysis of the fire came from Frederick Law Olmsted, a renowned landscape architect. Olmsted's analysis gave rise to significant changes in safety and building development. And credit goes also to Chicago civic and political leaders who took Olmsted's review and the recommendations of others and turned Chicago into a great American city that led the way for many other cities in the United States. Their leadership helped establish the country's first substantive fire codes. They also established a fire department full of well-trained and well-equipped firefighters. Finally, the most visible improvements came in the form of new skyscrapers of brick, stone, and mortar that became the nation's first beautiful skyline. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Save the world! Save the world! Save the world!
This is Green Under Pressure. I'm Rita Rich, and with me from Los Angeles is our host, Susan DiGiulio. Hey, Susan, while children in Bonn in Germany are chanting at the UN Climate Change Conference, our president is touring Asia and other places. But before he left, his administration released a report on a Friday afternoon when you really don't want news to be noticed. And that report was something that we did in one of our first episodes of Green Under Pressure. What was that report and why were we so afraid it would have been censored?
Yeah, that was pretty sneaky of them, wasn't it? So we're talking about the National Climate Assessment. Now, this is a report that comes out every 4 years. It goes back to the George H.W. Bush administration. He's the one who started it. And it was, you know, for all group of national agencies, 13 of them, to talk about the state of climate change and what needed to be done, where we were at. And we were worried that it would be muzzled, of course, because Scott Pruitt has been muzzling everything that has to do with climate change. And yet, I think that this actually did come out because there are so many other agencies involved in it, chief among them NASA and NOAA, which is the National Weather Organization. So I don't think they could keep it down. But the reason they didn't want it to come out, of course, is that it conclusively says climate change is real. There's no other significant source, and we're the only ones who can do anything about it.
The cool thing is Republicans have been concerned about climate change. It's not just been, you know, I'm a Republican, I don't want to breathe anymore. Let's move ahead. When did things start to get a little hinky for the GOP and climate change?
If you go back, the EPA itself was started by Nixon. So, you know, it's definitely, this is a planetary threat. And until around 2008, it was both parties were interested in following up the science and doing something about it. When you go back to when George W. Bush was elected, he was really, you know, very closely allied with the oil industry and really started to quash information about climate change. He reneged on a promise to reduce carbon emissions from coal plants. He decided to pull us out of the Kyoto Accord. So, you know, he kind of set this stage, and he did a lot of this by presidential edict, and, you know, that started us down this path. It's been sort of like you got Bush against science, Obama for science, Trump against science again, and they're always using these presidential mandates. Anyway, things got worse around 2008, because that's when the Koch brothers became very active in trying to keep the rest of the world from paying attention to what was going on with the climate. Yeah, these guys, as you know,
are... You've heard so much about them, and I see their commercials in some of the Sunday news talk shows about Koch Industries.
Yeah. These guys spend an enormous amount of money. I'm sure our listeners know, but they're the heads of an oil empire that puts out 600,000 barrels of crude a day, right? And in a recent five-year period, they invested $134 million in basically distracting us from the science of climate change. And one of their main organizations that they fund is called Americans for Prosperity. And in 2008, they had the Americans for Prosperity group draft this thing called the No Climate Change Tax Pledge that was sent to members of Congress. And basically they convinced the members of Congress that they needed to sign this, or else they would not be funded by the Kochs and when they ran their elections. And not only that, but their opponents would be funded. So you get into a situation. This first comes up in the 2010 election cycle. And of the 85 conservative Republicans first elected to the House of Representatives in that year, 76 had signed this pledge. And of those, 57 received money directly from the Koch brothers Political Action Committee. The Republicans that didn't sign found that their opponents were subsidized.
Oh, wow.
And at this point, we're talking about 140 members of the House, 26 senators, 8 governors, and hundreds of state legislatures who've been convinced that they have to sign this pledge and they have to abide by it, or else they won't be able to be elected to office as Republicans. It's just that simple. Thanks. Let's go back to Bonn, because that's a lot happier than this.
We do have a U.S. delegation there, and what will they be talking about in Bonn?
Oh, no, that's not good. Rita, they are presenting a paper titled The Role of Cleaner, More Efficient Fossil Fuels and Nuclear Power in Climate Mitigation.
Kidding me.
So, but the rest of the world is pushing ahead. The rest of the world is pushing ahead, and states too. Yeah, California's there. Jerry Brown's there. Yay.
Thanks, Susan DiGiulio. I'm Rita Rich of Flatlands Avenue Productions on the Progressive Voices Network.
Whether you are in or out of town on New Year's Day, I invite you to simply watch the Rose Bowl Parade on January 1st. Why? Because I have the honor as a kidney transplant recipient of riding on the Donate Life Float, thanks to my sponsor, Atlantis Piedmont Healthcare. What a cool experience to be in the Rose Bowl Parade. And you can find out more, see what the float looks like, and even become an organ donor at DonateLifeFloat.org. That's DonateLifeFloat.org. Welcome back to She Persisted. I'm your host, Melissa Carter. If you are not familiar with my prior work on broadcast radio, then you need to understand my mentality when it comes to holidays and the order in which they are in place. We learned a long time ago. Halloween comes in October. Thanksgiving comes in November, Christmas comes in December. But for some reason, there are people, and I know some of you are guilty, of putting up your Christmas decorations in September. You start playing Christmas music in October, and it grinds my nerves. I can't stand it. When I was on broadcast radio, I would do a thing called Save Halloween. And it was my campaign to save Halloween because too many stores in the Atlanta area, and I'm assuming across the country, were putting up Christmas trees and Christmas decorations before Halloween. And it was offensive. And I say offensive, I mean, it's a strong word, but it's offensive because just be patient. Just wait. Wait a second. Christmas will get here. Don't worry about it. And we'll celebrate it in its time. And people misinterpreted the fact that I didn't like Christmas. That is not the case at all. If Halloween decorations were up in stores in April, I would be offended. I mean, you have to do things in order. I teach my child to be patient and to wait. And for some reason, as adults, we're going to do it now. You know, we've gotten so into this please me now mentality that we, you know what, we're going to put the Christmas trees up. And if that store puts the Christmas trees up, then we got to put the Christmas trees up because we're not going to have them go buy the Christmas trees over theirs. It's ridiculous. You are insane. Nordstrom, I'm going to give a call out and shout out to Nordstrom. This is not endorsed, but it is an authentic shout out to Nordstrom because I love the fact that they let people know on their doors, we will not be putting up Christmas decorations until after Thanksgiving. They're the only department store that does that. I have already seen Christmas decorations up, and here it is the first week in November, first couple weeks in November. I mean, it's the day after Halloween that I saw things start popping up around stores. A friend of mine I was in a store with, and I started getting frustrated. She said, well, don't stress about it. Don't worry about it. She's even at the point where she doesn't give a shit anymore. And I'm like, this is wrong. It's just wrong because people are impatient. You can't, I feel like, you know, I enjoyed as a kid the holidays going in order. And I just feel like you're mixing things up to the point that nothing will be special anymore. Something that is special because it's not the norm. Do you understand that? Being special means that it's not a part of the norm. And so Christmas is special because it's this contained moment in time in December or at the end of November. You know, I have no problem with the day after Thanksgiving, everything being up, all the lights going up, all the trees going up. But it's a self-contained month of joy. I love Christmas. I don't like Christmas out of its time zone, basically. And yes, I mean, I get worked up about this. My friends make fun of me, but I'm serious. It really, truly bothers me that people think that, I don't know, like you're messing it up for everybody because that's what's happened. These stores are, the shopping centers now have their Christmas tree things on the lights and the decorations and the red and the green. And it's like, guys, seriously, it is not time. It's just not time yet. In the years that I did the Save Halloween campaign, I did notice that Halloween had a resurgence. I'm not saying that I'm responsible for that, but I think it tapped into what a lot of people felt. So I think Halloween is now, you know, being celebrated again without Christmas having to get in the way. But Thanksgiving, man, is getting derailed. If Thanksgiving is your favorite holiday, then I'm sorry because it looks like Thanksgiving's getting lost. So the reason I bring this up, not only to be on a soapbox, but there is a new study out that is proving that my theory is true, that things need to be special for a reason and that doing too much of it might be bad for your health. So here is a story from WPTV in West Palm Beach, Florida, to press my point.
Well, if you've avoided listening to Christmas music so far, it'll soon be nearly impossible.
Oh, it's gonna be everywhere. But is all that Christmas cheer good for your health? Maybe not. Turns out that constant festive tunes can actually be mentally draining. It's all because the more you hear, and we're starting right now, the more people try to focus on something else, eventually draining all their energy. Unfortunately, the Christmas music's not going to be stopping anytime soon. So, one thing to think about, how about mixing up that playlist? Don't play the same ones over and over again.
Did you hear that? Playing too much Christmas music could be bad for your health. This is based on a British psychology study that says listening to Christmas music, I'll just reiterate what the TV people say because I'm not sure they explained it very well, but the Christmas music could harm your mental health because it reminds you of things you need to do. So the music in the car, the music in the stores, instead of it being special, it turns into obligation of a to-do list of what you need to do before the holidays are done. So this is what we've turned into. Is just a consumer culture that Christmas music now just trips up in your mind all the errands you have to run. instead of you being able to fill your heart with joy, which is what Christmas is supposed to do. And I just think it's another thing where it's too much of a good thing is not good. Like, I love chocolate. I love my son more than anything in this world. Chocolate is close. I love chocolate. But if I eat chocolate every day, what would happen? If I eat chocolate all the time, what would happen? There's a desire, yes. Oh, chocolate makes me happy. I want to eat chocolate all the time. But I can't do that. And the same with my birthday. My birthday is March 11th. Hint. But if I start celebrating my birthday today, you would call me nuts. You would say, why are you celebrating your birthday in November when it's in March? Well, my point, why would you celebrate Christmas when we haven't even gotten to Thanksgiving yet? I really am strict about it. I don't put on a Christmas playlist until the day after Thanksgiving or maybe Thanksgiving Day. When I gather with the Carter family, you know, we'll play Christmas music during Thanksgiving meals on Thanksgiving. That's fine because you're at Thanksgiving. That's fine. But what irritates me, it's not because it's Christmas. It could be anything. It's not Christmas. That's the thing. I'm not attacking Christmas. It's the fact that you are impatient. You are impatient. And if you are someone who needs that all the time, if you put your Christmas tree up in September and you leave it up till February, then I really think you need to reevaluate things that make you happy in your life. Christmas can't be a crutch. I'm just laughing about how long I've talked about this, but it's true. And I love that there's study that has vindicated me. Yes, but just keep things special. That's it. I think people get defensive because now we're competitive about Christmas. No, everybody loves Christmas. Or even if you're not Christian, I mean, everybody loves the spirit of everybody coming together in love. And just don't push it to where people dread it and don't look forward to it. And I'm afraid that's where we're going. And I don't want that to happen. Okay. You can always email me to askmelissacarter@gmail.com is my email address. And I'll get berated every year. Every year people talk about how I'm attacking Christmas every year. And I love Christmas. I love it. All right. So let's take a break. Let me do some deep breath chants, and we'll be back with She Persisted after this on the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Melissa Carter.
Hey, Progressive Voices listeners. I'm Rebecca Vallis, host of Off Kilter, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund here on the Progressive Voices Network. This week, I spoke with Seth Hanlon, one of the tax gurus at the Center for American Progress, about what's in the Republican tax plan. Is it really for the middle class? Spoiler, it's not. Let's take a listen. I want to get to some more of what's in the plan. I mean, we could sort of go through, like, point by point all of these things. But I think it's really important to also take on one of the other major talking points that Republicans have been really crusading with, which is about the child tax credit. Mm-hmm. Ivanka Trump, during her father's presidential campaign, was out there on the stump all the time talking about how she was going to be the architect of a massive paid leave plan, a massive child care plan. Her father was going to be the best for women and families that we'd ever seen. And to date, what we've seen is a pretty paltry paid leave plan from President Trump that Ivanka designed, or so we're told. And now in this tax bill, a child tax credit increase that Republicans are touting as a huge, huge benefit to families. Right. Are they right? And is that fair?
It's vastly overstated. I mean, so like you mentioned earlier, this tax plan gives with one hand and takes away with the other. So they increase the child tax credit by several hundred dollars. But at the same time, they eliminate personal exemptions and dependent exemptions for families. So right now you can deduct basically $4,000 from your income from every member of your family. So giving it a larger tax credit might make up for that, but you're basically getting families back to zero. So it's certainly not a game changer by any means in terms of helping families afford the expenses of raising children or the expenses of childcare.
Well, and we keep hearing Kevin Brady and Paul Ryan and others claim, oh my God, we're giving families something like a $1,200 annual tax cut. Right. A lot of that, they're pointing to the child tax credit as part of that. And even if those numbers did add up, and you noted before, there's some limits on this, right?
Yes.
they decided to make the corporate tax cuts permanent.
Right.
And some of what you were just talking about that would actually help families even modestly, they actually decided to make it time limited. It expires after just 5 years.
Yep.
And you know, that's, I think, an important point to make. But Seth, you're a parent, right? You have, mm-hmm. How many kids do you have?
I have three.
You have three kids. And so how far would $1,200 a year go for you in offsetting the costs of those kids? Really far, right? It would like cover everything?
Yeah, I don't know. It'll cover maybe 1 month's after school activities, maybe. I don't know. Washington's DC is a special case, I think.
But it's expensive to raise kids, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and this is it fair to say this is basically a drop in the bucket when it comes to what it actually takes to
yeah.
cover the cost of childbearing?
I think that, I mean, compared to the corporate tax cuts, this is a drop in the bucket. And I think that's important because the corporate tax cuts are going to have real consequences for middle class families in other ways. When we, you know, increase the deficit by $1.5 trillion, there's no doubt that, I mean, we can just look to the Republican budgets to tell us how they're going to pay for those tax cuts.
Well, let's talk about that,
yeah.
right? Because most of what people have been talking about is what's in this tax plan,
mm-hmm.
the four corners of the tax
right.
plan. And we'll talk about kind of what happens next and how it's likely to change and what happens when the Senate is taking it up and some of the kind of, you know, procedural rules that end up being really important here. But you just made a really important connection, which is how are we actually ultimately going to pay for all of this? Thanks for listening. For more Off Kilter, find us on the Progressive Voices Network and as a podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at Off Kilter Show and at facebook.com/Off Kilter Show.
Over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house we go. The horse knows the way to carry the sleigh through white and drifted snow. Over the river and through the woods, oh, how the wind does blow. It stings the toes and bites the nose as over the ground we go. Everybody now.
Yes, please. Let's sing along, everybody. Over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house we go. Yes, that's the Thanksgiving song. Remember, that's the song that we learned when we were kids. I mean, it's a shame we don't have a catalog of Thanksgiving songs that we can be playing right now because you get tired of that song over and over again. But that is what we should be playing in stores. We should be talking about Thanksgiving that's coming up and the fact that that is, it's really a glimpse into like nostalgic America. Because I always have to remind people that who really complain about how our country seems to be falling apart. But, you know, Thanksgiving is the only American holiday in this holiday season. Like Halloween is international. Christmas is international. New Year's is international. Thanksgiving is solely an American holiday. So you would think that we would use that time to really reconnect, because that's what Thanksgiving's about, is reconnecting with the people you love and the people that love you. And you do it by preparing food together and sitting at a table and eating it together and catching up and spending time with each other, spending quality time with each other. And I mean, like, I don't own a dining room table. I don't own a dining room table because I never eat there. And it's kind of an expense that I don't need, because it ends up being a craft table or a laundry table or everything else but food and preparing it and sitting at a table. Now, I'm not a great cook anyway, and I'm single, which adds to that. But even when I was with Katie, she and I, we didn't sit at the dining room table and eat dinner at night. We were lucky if we ate dinner together at night. I mean, look where we ended up. But I think that it's important. And so, yes, I'm very disappointed that this has become an issue, because Thanksgiving is a special time. And we really have the potential to come together and make it a great holiday for this country, because we need it. Gosh, we need that. We need something. And for those who think that Christmas is the answer, not yet. No, I think Thanksgiving's the answer right now, that we need to be doing that. You can always email me. I mentioned an email address earlier, askmelissacarter@gmail.com. And you can ask me anything. You can tell me how much you disagree with me, you agree with me, or if there's something you really want me to talk about on the show, then please, please let me know. I would love that. It's our show together. It's not just my show. You can always reach out to me on Twitter at Melissa Carter, 1L2S's, plus on Instagram and Facebook, it's Melissa Carter ATL. And then we have ShePersistedShow.com, where you can catch all the episodes of She Persisted, plus iTunes. Do not forget about iTunes. If you are already on iTunes, just look for the show and you can subscribe to the podcast right there. It's the easiest thing to do. And then you can catch up on all the shows and see all the descriptions. And I would love for you to do that and tell your friends about it. And I can't reiterate enough how taking care of yourself is vitally important. and, you know, as well as taking care of others. We've focused on the show today about taking care of others, but yeah, take care of yourself too. So please, today, do something for yourself. It doesn't matter if I care about it. It doesn't matter if your husband or boyfriend or children or parent, it doesn't matter who cares about it, as long as you care about it and it makes you smile. So I would love for you to do that for yourself today. And like Lucille Ball said, love yourself first and everything falls into place. So I hope you have a great day, great start of the week. Let's start this week off great. And I will see you tomorrow morning. This is She Persisted. I'm your host, Melissa Carter, and I look forward to it. Have a great day. Bye-bye.